One, two, three, five!
To many fans, it's quite simple. They were the greatest band in rock history. John Lennon once said they were just a band that made it very, very big. Nonetheless, the story is the stuff of great fiction. Four young British lads running about Liverpool looking for a gig. Any gig. A few years later, they were the most famous men on the planet. They were the Beatles. It's hard to write or say anything that hasn't already been seen and heard about them. But for the next hour, we'll explore the Beatles from a unique perspective, firsthand by the people that were really there. It was the mid-50s, and after hearing Elvis Presley, a young Brit named John Lennon wanted to be a rock and roll musician. Finding the outlet, though, and getting the skills to play rock music was difficult in the UK. But there was a peculiar form of music called skiffle. It was a hybrid of American folk, blues, and hillbilly. And best of all, it required little training and no expensive instruments. The young Lennon put together a group of school friends and started playing parties and skiffle contests. They called themselves the Quarrymen. Colin Hatton was their first drummer.
The original lineup was John Lennon, obviously, vocals, Eric Griffiths on guitar, there was Rod Davis on banjo, there was Len Gary on TTS bass, and there was me on the drums, Pete Shop was on washboard. So that was the original lineup of the Quarrymen.
One day, after playing in the field behind St. Peter's Church, one of Lennon's friends would introduce him to a young Paul McCartney.
Yeah, we met Paul by a mutual friend of theirs. Ivan Vaughan brought Paul to meet John, because he knew that Paul was playing guitar. I don't remember, but apparently in the church hall during the interval, Paul played 20 Flight Rock on John's guitar, sort of upside down, which apparently is not too difficult to play. It's three chords. I wouldn't like it, but apparently it's not difficult if you're a guitarist. So that impressed John. And Pete Shotton tells the story that walking home that night, he asked Pete what he thought of that lad, you know, Paul McCartney. And Pete said, I thought he was brilliant. So John said, what do you think about asking him to join the group? Which is what Pete reckons he did when he saw him about 2 weeks later. He asked him to join the Quarrymen, which he did. And by the time he joined, Rod Davis had decided to pack up. He was going to concentrate on his studies. Pete Shotton sort of gave up on the washboard because, although skiffle got us, everybody started, skiffle was a fairly short-lived thing. People were looking more for rock and roll, so washboard didn't really go very well with a rock and roll band.
After losing Rod Davis on banjo and Pete Shotton on washboard, Paul McCartney recruited two more schoolmates, John Charles Lowe on piano, and a local boy named George Harrison. During the summer of 1958, the Quarrymen went into a small studio in Liverpool and recorded a song penned by McCartney and Harrison. The Quarrymen would change lineups constantly in the late 50s, and names as well. First to the Silver Beatles, and then to just Beatles. By the end of 1961, the Beatles were John Lennon, Paul McCartney, George Harrison, and Pete Best on drums, and they were exploding on the local music scene. They also caught the attention of local record store manager Brian Epstein, who was soon managing the band. He quickly got the Beatles an audition at Decca Records, using the first song ever written by John Lennon. The audition didn't go well, and Decca rejected the Beatles. Here's Brian Epstein reading from his autobiography.
I secured them an audition at Decca on New Year's Day 1962. They came to London and stayed at the Royal Hotel, paying 27 shillings a night for bed and breakfast. They were poor and I wasn't rich, but we all celebrated with rum and scotch and coke, which was becoming a Beatle drink even then. Well, the recording test came and went. The people that decide about these things at Decca said no. Well, you could imagine I was more worried about what I was going to say to the boys, having built up their hopes. So I allowed myself a final 24 hours to exhaust the remaining disc companies, and I booked into the Green Park Hotel. In the morning, I took a cab to the EMI office block in Manchester Square, London, to meet the man who would, within less than 2 years, produce 16 number one discs by my artists.
That man was George Martin. Epstein was grooming the boys for success by changing their appearance, dispensing with their leather jackets and pants in favor of tailored suits and ties. George Martin, too, was making changes, reportedly telling Epstein that drummer Pete Best wasn't good enough to drum on the recordings. In late summer 1962, Epstein fired Best, and the remaining three Beatles asked Ringo Starr to join the band. Once in the studio, they recorded Love Me Do, a Lennon and McCartney original, and a song that would reach the top of the U.S. charts nearly 18 months later.
Love, love me do. You know I love you. I'll always be true. So please, love me do. Love me do.
Weeks later, the group would be in George Martin's studio again, recording Please Please Me. It would go on to top the British charts in early 1963. Head judge for ABC's Dancing with the Stars TV show, Len Goodman, remembers.
Now, my first memory of the Beatles, I was 19 years old, and there was the big mods and rockers, and I was a mod. And we used to go down to Brighton every weekend on our scooters into the pub called the Skylark, which was right on Brighton Beach. Suddenly, on the jukebox has come this song, and almost all of us in the pub stopped because it was so vibrant and so good. And of course, we all said, what's that track? Please Please Me by the Beatles. And after that, that's all we put on all night long. So in between having fights with the rockers on the beach, we were back in the Skylight pub, listening to the Beatles and Please Please Me. Fabulous.
Last night I said these words to my girl. I know you never even tried, girl. Come on, 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 come on. Please, please me, oh yeah, like I please you. You don't need me to show.
After several TV appearances, Beatlemania was beginning to take hold across the British Isles in late 63. And there were plenty of screams to go along with it.
Oh yeah, oh yeah, oh yeah, oh yeah. Imagine I'm in love with you. It's easy because I know.
On a cold day in February, the Beatles left London for an appearance in the U.S. Upon their arrival at JFK in New York, the four lads from Liverpool were greeted by thousands of screaming fans. 2 days later, from the CBS studios, they would make their first live American television appearance on the Ed Sullivan Show.
Ladies and gentlemen, the Beatles!
Close your eyes and I'll kiss you. Tomorrow I'll miss you. Remember, I'll always need you. And before I'm away, I'll ride home every day. And I'll send all my loving to you. I'll pretend that I'm kissing the lips I am missing.
Beatlemania had crossed the ocean and was proving to be even bigger than it had been in Britain. By April of 1964, the Beatles held the top five spots on the American music chart. Anyone who thought the Beatles were just a passing fad, their prognostications were soon vanquished with the release of A Hard Day's Night. The Beatles were at the top of their game.
It's been a hard day's night, and I've been working like a dog. It's been a hard day's night, I should be sleeping like a log. But when I get home to you, I find the things that you do will make me feel
group's 1965 performance at Shea Stadium marked the first time in the history of popular music that anyone had played in a stadium, setting a new world record for concert attendance with nearly 56,000 screaming fans. But could anyone, including the Beatles, really hear anything? Phil Collins explains.
The equipment, even at Shea Stadium, they used, I mean, I dread to think what it must have sounded like. You know, if you set up a stage like that in the middle of a baseball stadium, and you could see what equipment they have from the films. You know, it's like a 60-watt bass amp and a 100-watt guitar amp, or you know, electric piano going through a 30-watt. I mean, the PA, it was before PA systems were really sophisticated. So probably, I mean, the audience could barely hear anything, I would think, especially over their own screaming. But even if they hadn't been screaming, I think most of the sound would have been coming out of those little kind of horns, like the public address system, you know. Playing number 13 today would be, you know, Reggie, what name? That would be what their music would be coming out of, I guess, because PA systems really were very Spartan in those days, and you carried around, you literally carry an amp, all the drum kit fitted in a case, one case for all the stands. I mean, now it's like five trunks fit for cymbal stands.
Can't buy me love. Money can buy me love. I'll give you all I've got to give if you say you love me too. I may not have a lot to give, but what I got, I'll give to you. I don't care too much for money. The money can buy me love. Can buy me love. Everybody tells me so.
In 1966, the Beatles became the first musical group to perform at Budokan Hall in Tokyo. But with their growing international fame, security was now taking a bigger priority. Then Beatles tour manager Tony Barrow explains.
What we found was that the Tokyo Hilton Hotel was absolutely crawling with security. Every alternate room on the floor, we had an entire floor for the Beatles and entourage, and every alternate room along the corridor was being occupied by security forces. Also, as we drove from the Tokyo Hilton to the Budokan venue, the streets were lined with fans, but there were armed security guys on bridges and at intersections, road intersections along the route. And I remember the Beatles being absolutely appalled by this, and saying, they're only harmless fans. In fact, the fans in Japan were more polite and more courteous and less rowdy, less better behaved than the fans in a number of countries we'd visited. But in fact, the Beatles couldn't understand why this huge security was on hand there to protect them from these harmless and adoring Japanese fans. Well, of course, the answer is that's not what the security forces were there for at all. They were there to watch out for snipers and to minimise the chance of the Beatles being killed on the way to or at the venue. And I remember inside the venue, an enormous number of people with very, very high power, large high power camera lenses looking out across the crowd. And at first, naturally enough, I assumed they were media photographers. They were not. They were security people who, in fact, weren't training their cameras on the stage or on the four Beatles at all, but on likely areas of the audience where there might be snipers with guns. So it was a very real death threat, which the Beatles only half heard about. They knew there was something afoot, but they really didn't realise the seriousness of the situation that we all took very seriously, and the Japanese police took seriously, to the extent that I felt that they weren't so much concerned about the possible assassination of Beatles, but the assassination of Beatles on their territory. They were very concerned that something dramatic like that should occur on their soil and make them look rather sort of ham-fisted at handling their own security arrangements. So for their sake, for their own sake, they were prepared to spend whatever it took in the way of extra forces to see that the Beatles were safe there.
Next, from Tokyo to the Philippines, and a controversy that would make the Beatles fear for their lives when the Beatles, Rare and Unseen, continues.